Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. Ooh, that was good. It is... Actually, today is probably one of my favorite days of the year. October 1st. Jen, do you know why October 1st is my favorite day of the year?
I have no idea, because it's not going to have anything to do with pumpkin spice. So just go ahead and tell
me. It is because I enjoy October, November, and December, this three-month period, more than any 3 months of the entire year. I think, well, at the end of the month, Halloween, then I can say next month is Thanksgiving. I can say next month is Black Friday reveal day. And it just, I don't know. October, November, and December are my favorite. Even when October in LA is frighteningly hot sometimes, which it's not right now. But even when it is, I know that the days are a little bit shorter, so I'm only going to have to put up with that brutal heat until the sun goes down earlier. I'm not a person who hates that it gets dark early. I'm just not that person. I think I would be different if I lived in England or something, or really someplace far north where it got dark at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
I wouldn't like that very much. Yeah, LA's been kind of gloomy, I would say, this weekend, then it kind of burns off. But, you know, the East Coast is always a good place to travel during the fall because you can see the leaves change. True. And I like to be a leaf peeper. I love everything about, like what you said, October, November, December, because it's all related to food. It's when the good food starts coming out, you know, pecan pies, and then we get ready for Thanksgiving, and you and I just, we love to eat. We love to talk about eating. So Thanksgiving, Christmas, anything to do with big spreads, you know, hey, we're good.
It is. And also, you know, being in LA, there's not a huge difference between June 20th and December 20th when it comes to time. So I guess that's why I just, when it gets dark, then I go, oh, you know what? Then it's the best time of the holiday season and stuff. I don't know. So October 1st.
And maybe it's just the idea, right, of this fall, and it's cozy, and we start, you know, settling into like our home spaces, and just, I don't know, not just with COVID, we've been, you know, settled in anyways, but you know, now it's just, I don't know, we're just more inviting, more cozy, and I know it's the best time of year. I have to agree with you.
So it is, and it's also October 1st, first Friday, and this is quite the little tale that you have found for us. And I know that it's a big deal. There's a podcast about it. The Irish Times wrote a big thing about it, which I kind of used as a jumping off point for my research. And it is the case of Peter Bergman. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Peter Bergman?
This case goes back to June 2009. So this man who called himself Peter Bergman checked into the Sligo Hotel, and that's in Ireland. It's a sleepy coastal beach town. And, you know, as it turns out, he's not the man that people thought he was. He goes on to wash up on shore, you know, of this like isolated beach. And to this day, no one's ever been able to identify him. And he did this series of mysterious things leading up to his death that just make no sense. It's kind of very reminiscent of the Somerton Man, you know, the Isdell woman, Jennifer Fergate, that kind of situation. And, you know, we'll get into like the fact that he had no tags in his clothes and stuff like that. So I feel like you and I do either locked room mysteries, or we do people that have these identities that are shrouded in mystery, and, you know, their clothes and possessions just give us no indication as to where to go.
Well, I know you are an aficionado of the who are they kind of people. And I am
it.
More,
yeah,
and I'm more of a locked room. I'm more of a locked room guy, but they both are, because the reason the locked room is just all about mystery and, oh, how did this happen? How could it have possibly happened? And then with the unidentified people, it's not even so much that we don't know. I mean, cause I think that you and I both agree on, you know, why this guy did what he did, but it's as far as the death goes, but you're just like, why did he pick Sligo? Who was this guy? Why did he hide everything? What happened to all this other stuff? And that's what makes it crazy interesting.
It's a series of events that lead up to not only his death, but the events alone, if you just isolate them, they are the most mysteriously intriguing things, because this guy either really thought things through, or it's a case of where there's maybe mental illness, dementia, something like that. And maybe he didn't think things through. And that's kind of what I want the audience to judge for themselves. You know, was this guy crazy as a fox, or, you know, was he just sadly just crazy?
Well, let's start with, you know, the almost the end, when his body was found. It's not that long ago. We're not talking a long time ago. But I will say that the Irish police have been put thousands and thousands of hours into this. And he was found in 2009, in June of 2009. So think about what I just said earlier about this is June 16th. It's Ireland. It stays light for a very, very long time. And that's kind of important as we wind down to other parts and you go, well, how did this person get spotted at that time of night? Just remember, it's June 16th. It probably doesn't get dark until 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And he was found at 6 a.m. There's this guy, I guess, training for a triathlon or something like that, and runs ahead. And the next thing you know, hey, he sees a body of a person face downwards on the sand.
Yeah, and at first he didn't realize what he was exactly looking at because he's training for this triathlon. 6 in the morning, there's a sea fog that gives heavy cover over this beach. So you don't see anything until you're right up on it. And he thought at first, you know, is this a real person? You know, is this a mannequin? What is it? And sure enough, it was a dead man. And, you know, he was with his father. So they immediately said a prayer for the man and then contacted the authorities. And the guy was, you know, this Peter Bergman was completely naked and no identification on him.
Yeah, it was interesting. And they said, you know, he looked about 65. They walked around the body. They wanted to make sure that he was dead. I think it's probably pretty obvious, but, you know, they double checked. So they call the police. And the guy says, hey, there's this body. And the policeman does the smart thing. He goes, oh, well, there's a body. So he found like a tarp or something like that, because if there was a body, they want to cover it. So that way people aren't just staring at some naked dead guy on the beach.
Yeah, they were very concerned about tourism in this area. So the first thing they wanted to do was cover the body, which a lot of people will scrutinize that move because of contamination of the scene and things like that. It doesn't appear that they were concerned about the integrity of crime scene and preserving anything. They may have immediately thought it was a suicide. So they just started touching things and just covering the body and, you know, keeping onlookers away. So main concern here was, you know, not to preserve the corpse, but to protect tourism. And you know, that's something that they'll continue to rip law enforcement about.
So Friday, June 12th, we're going to go back in time. Now we have our dead guy, Peter Bergman, on the beach, but we're going to go back, rewind to Friday, the afternoon of June 12th. And the first time anybody has spotted, now here's the thing. I know this is the first time that they spot him. He's at the Derry bus station. You know, he's captured on CCTV. But how did he get into the bus station? Do we not know that? I mean, we've got him captured at the bus station. But which door did he come in from? And the thing about, which I've, in England and Ireland and all that, they have CCTV everywhere, as you and I have discovered. Every time we do some kind of English one, British one, somebody's always captured on CCTV, which is not the case necessarily when we do a US one. It feels like they can follow them every single block. So it's interesting that we don't know where he came from before he came into the bus station.
And you make a good point, because that will come up in this case over and over again about how did he know all the different blind spots of where he could avoid CCTV or any type of surveillance, because he does that throughout the entire tale. Just when he's about to do something very pertinent to the case, something that we need to see, we need to learn, blind spot. You know, his action is missed. And he was just so good at that. I mean, this guy was clean cut. You know, he's first seen wearing a black leather jacket, carrying two bags. You know, so we see him with stuff.
Yeah. So it's important. Let's say exactly what he's carrying, because this is important as we go through. So he's got two black bags. One of them is like a duffel bag, with two handles. And then the other is kind of like a laptop type bag slung over his shoulder. So we don't have any massive suitcases or anything. We have like a duffel bag, and not a big duffel bag, but a duffel bag, and then just kind of a laptop bag. And he went looking for the Sligo bus, which was leaving at 4 o'clock. So for 2 hours and 28 minutes, he had, he was riding the bus and stuff. So he gets on the bus, and then we see him again in Sligo, again on CCTV.
Yeah, the thing about him is that he did have a conversation with someone in the transit system. He asked him about bus times and things like that. but he goes on to not hold conversations with people unless it is absolutely necessary, unless he is lost, he needs to know something, even after he arrives to a hotel, minimal contact. He's not someone that is openly, you know, reaching out to people unless forced.
Yeah, he's not chatty. Now, he gets to Sligo, and this bus station, and also the train station, by the way, are within walking distance of hotels. And this is kind of where everything that he did later on is just strange about this part. Because he seems to know, okay, well, he knows where all the CCTV cameras and stuff, but he gets at the bus station. There are hotels within walking distance, but he gets into a taxi and asks the driver to take him to a cheap place to stay. Is that so he doesn't have to go into each of these hotels that he could walk to and ask how much a room is? And he's just, I'm going to ask one person, the taxi driver, and he'll know where a cheap hotel is.
Yeah, it could be a thing of convenience, or as we get into his health history, maybe he was not in a mood or condition to walk. Even though it was a short distance to these hotels, he had a health condition that was plaguing him. So True. If it was a day that he was in pain, maybe he vouched for a quick ride.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that when I was doing it. But you make a very good point. And that's, in fact, maybe why he gets a ride everywhere. So he goes to one hotel, it's full, and they drop him off at another hotel, which is right next to the one place that you can catch a taxi. You know, you can't just wave your hand for a taxi in this particular town. You have to go to the taxi area, the rank, I believe they call them. So that's where he is, and he checks in. And this is where the big problems start. Big, big problems. And I'm assuming that because they have CCTV of the lobby, that we know he didn't pay the desk clerk a bribe.
No, it doesn't look like it. He seemingly checks in, as anybody would, pays cash for his room, and he purchases by the day. So it's not like he bought an entire week or anything like that. It's just a day-by-day thing. And again, he has minimal contact with the clerk. He just hands her the money. She gives him room keys, and you know, he disappears into his room.
So he gets the clerk says, well, you know, he had an Austrian or German accent. That's what they said. So that's what we have. We have our first clue of who he is. And it's 6:52 p.m. that he checks in. They know exactly when the person checks them in. It's a single occupancy room. The room costs 65 euros a night. And he gets room 705 in case you ever want to go to the Sligo City Hotel. Room 705. He writes in the hotel register that his name's Peter Bergman, but he wasn't asked for any identification at all.
Yeah, remember those days where you could check into places and get by with stuff like that? You know, you can't do that anymore, but we've had so many cases. You know, again, Jennifer Fergate, the Isdell woman, all of these people check into hotels and you have no earthly idea who they are. It's just whatever identity they may have put together. And, you know, since he had a German accent, some people speculate that he was possibly interested in a German scientist that had a very similar name. You know, we'll never know. But again, just no proof of identity, wasn't asked to produce. So he goes on to his single occupancy room, and he ends up staying at this hotel for 3 nights.
Yeah. I guess because he was paying cash that they didn't ask him for his ID. Apparently it's a law in Ireland that you do have to ask for ID. It's not an optional thing.
That's why it would be nice to have the backstory, the real story of what was the conversation like between him and the clerk, really? You know, did she even ask for ID? And then what story did he give? Oh, I left it in the taxi, or I lost it, you know, and then they decide to have mercy on him and give him a room anyways. There's always a backstory, and, you know, that's what's missing in a lot of these true crime stories. And we can't go back and get it because these people have either passed away that are witness to it, or, you know, they're so scattered that you can't find them.
I'm guessing that it never even came up where I don't know. The police have never said. The police are very upset that the clerk didn't ask for identification, but it's never been, hey, let's throw the clerk under the bus, as in they took some story that he didn't have it. We don't know that part. We just know that the police were upset that they didn't ask for identification. And Sligo City Hotel has a bunch of cameras, And the one of them points over the reception desk and another at the front door through which all guests must come and go. So we know he couldn't get around that one. So we know when he came in and when he left every time over those 3 days, and it was a bunch.
Yeah, sometimes he is seen wearing the same clothes, just he does little alterations here and there with them. And sometimes he is seen carrying these purple bags, and it seems like that he would have a good bit of items in these purple bags. They're almost like grocery bags, you know, like the real cheap plastic kind that you would get, that would normally be a bit like beige or white now, but over, I guess, in Ireland or wherever he came from, they're this bright color purple, so they're hard to miss on the CCTV. And then he goes throughout town, and I guess he disperses these items in different waste bins and stuff, but always off camera. He always picks a blind spot. So they were never able to retrieve these items. And then he comes back with either the bag empty or no bag at all. And it's always speculation if he carried the purple bag in his pocket, because, you know, he keeps getting seen with the purple bag. So is it the same bag, or did he have multiple bags?
So imagine you're a police detective after the fact here, and you're looking at the CCTV stuff, and you see Peter Bergman leaving the hotel, and you see him leaving with a bag, purple bag, filled. It's filled. They can tell that it has stuff in it. And he leaves the hotel over the course of these 3 days at least 13 times. 13 times going back and forth, which is quite a lot. And
that is a lot of coming and going.
It really is. Because, you know, you could say, okay, I'm going to – it seems – a bunch. And they see him leaving every single time with this full plastic bag, and each time he comes back and there's nothing in it, or he doesn't even have a bag. Where is it? And
well, he wore that black leather jacket, and it's not a heavy jacket, you know, it's like a medium type of let's say a cargo flight jacket, and he could have had multiple pockets on the inside to stash that bag, because the bag, if you go on to watch the footage of CCTV, it starts to look worn down. You know, very wrinkled and stuff, almost as if it's been crumpled multiple times. And so I kind of think people might be onto something, that he's recycling the same bag.
Yeah, I think he's recycling the same bag. But if you – the detective back in 2009 was this guy named John O'Reilly. And he – there are hundreds upon hundreds of CCTV cameras around Sligo. And just as many a decade ago, and not a single piece of footage, not a single frame anywhere – in the entirety of the town, shows Peter Bergman disposing of the contents of this bag 13 times.
Right. So it begs the question, had he visited this area before? How did he know it so well? And how did he know where the security cameras were? I mean, even if you visit an area and then you return 6 months later, years later, you never know what new business has cropped up and has, you know, newly installed surveillance. So, I mean, how was he so good?
I don't think that even if you're amazingly good and you've scouted it out, then you're still not going to be able to avoid it 13 times, I don't think. But here's the other thing that I really don't understand is, if you're saying, okay, he knew where the cameras were, then I don't know how long they keep the CCTV footage, but shouldn't the detectives go back and, I don't know, look for him again or something, or go look at, and I know it's hard to look at the entire town and go back 6 months and find the guy or whatever, but I would go back to what he did on the way there, was he took a bus from Derry Station. And so maybe just go look at the bus from Derry Station going back 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months to see if he had been there before, because there's no way that you're that good where you can avoid every camera in the entire town.
Well, initially, when he washed up and, you know, the death investigation began, it closed very quickly. They were not interested in pursuing this at first. You know, Ireland, where he may have been from, they just weren't interested. They had reached out to Interpol on fingerprints and a Peter Bergman, that name and things like that in his age range, and nothing came back. But Interpol, they weren't real helpful, and they didn't want to pursue it because they said, well, Ireland doesn't have any missing persons and Germany doesn't have any missing persons that match his, you know, the physical features of what they see at their medical examiner's office. So they're just like, you know, if no one's looking for him, we don't have the time or the finance to pursue this. So it just became one of those things to where, okay, well, he's a UID. It's a cold case. If it ever surfaces who he is, great. But, you know, we're not going to fully pursue it. It was only after people really started you know, like journalists digging in, asking questions, that they started going back and looking at CCTV and stuff like that. By then, you've lost so much time in the investigation, CCTV footage will start over. And, you know, they probably don't have it if he ever previously visited.
Yeah. I mean, it would be nice if they did, because then they could go back and see if he scoured the town. But it boggles the mind, even if, because, again, they did, like you said, they didn't go back and look at it for quite some time. So one of the things that could have happened is, let's say he knew about one camera right outside the hotel that was a blind spot, and he could have just walked out of the hotel, dumped it all in a trash can or something, and continued on with his day. Because by the time they came back and looked, all those trash bags would have been emptied and out at the dump. So,
you know, in the United States, there's a grid system. Every single trash can everywhere, doesn't matter where it is, whether it's residential or commercial, they know exactly in the dump where it has been taken and dumped. So they could have went through the different, if they have that same system in Ireland, I don't know how advanced they are, they could go through and figure out, you know, since he used so many waste baskets, what it was he threw away. And maybe perhaps he goes on to throw away the purple bags, and that would have been an indication they found the right little lorry bins or waste bins or whatnot. It doesn't seem like they went that far with it. They may have peeked into different waste receptacles and were like, oh, well, they've already been emptied. It's like, yeah, because, you know, you wasted weeks before you looked.
Yeah. But it is interesting. So I guess, so he has, remember, he has a duffel bag and a laptop type bag. 13 trips to empty out stuff in this bag, and nobody knows. My guess is, well, actually, I don't even have a guess, but it's obviously stuff that was in the duffel bag, and it could have been just everything, his personal effects, and he's just taking them out a little bit at a time and then throwing them away.
Which is a smart thing to do. If you're going to start consolidating your life, you're throw away a little bit at a time in all these different baskets, which makes it not easy to put a puzzle together, especially if you're trying to keep your, you know, you want to be anonymous. You're trying to keep your mystery in place. And it seems like he was all about a puzzle.
Yeah. And he did keep anonymous. Like you said, originally, other than functional transactions that he had at the hotel reception desk or at the bus station, he didn't talk to anybody. He didn't have a conversation with anybody. He didn't have a mobile phone. He didn't use anything like that. We don't know about a passport. We don't know about any of this kind of stuff. He didn't have any of it. And
no,
one of the
man that would step out and he would smoke a cigarette, and that's on CCTV. He always kept at least one hand in his pocket at all times. And he was a guy who wasn't really keen on holding the door for other guests. If there was someone coming in behind him, he would rather the door just shut on them than to hold it. So, you know, just kind of background information on him and what his personality might have been like.
Well, because if you hold it, then people get a good look at your face because they turn and they thank you. And you're in an awkward position where your face is completely exposed. So he came into town Friday. So on Saturday, on Friday, we missed the one chance with reception where we didn't get any ID. So that's a big miss number one. Then big miss number two, where we had a chance to really, this was where you really had a chance to figure out who he was, where he came from, all this kind of stuff. And it got blown because he goes to the post office on Saturday and they know what he bought. And they know how many of them he bought. And, you know, because he bought 10 82-cent stamps and was given airmail stickers. And the police know that in 2009, it cost 55 cents to post a letter within Ireland. An 82-cent stamp would take the letter to the rest of the world. So
yeah, that's fascinating. So that makes us believe that he was either mailing maybe personal effects to someone that he cared about, or there is at least someone in the world that he knew, you know, because a person needs to pick up these items.
So 10 people, 10 of them.
Or could he have mailed 10 items to the 10 packages to the same, you know, person? I don't know. It just seems like there's someone out there that knew him and a reason why he thought it would be pertinent to get rid of these items and put them in the hands of another person. I mean, he's seen, you know, we don't know what he threw away, but he's seen throwing stuff away. He doesn't care about it. He's consolidating, yet he's got this thought that he may want to mail something to someone. But, you know, does he go on to do that?
Well,
it doesn't seem like he did.
Well, here's the thing. They don't know. Okay, because the transaction was captured on CCTV. And the Sligo post office has boxes inside and outside the building. And there is a camera over the boxes that stand near its left-hand entrance. But if you post letters in the outside boxes, there are no cameras. And the other problem is the detective, they got the CCTV footage from the post office. And when they went to look at it, it had been downloaded by a staff member. And for some strange reason, the footage hadn't actually gone on to the USB stick. And when they went back to the post office, it was gone off their system.
That's so convenient, though, isn't it, to his story? Because not only is he good at avoiding surveillance, but now he has help because the Postal Service, they don't have their act together and they're not really recording anyways. It seems like a lot of these companies are not actually recording. It's either dummy cameras or the system is not tied into the city system. And I don't know, things just get lost. And, you know, this was important.
It was. And if they had that, that USB stick, if they had that video, then they could, they said, you know, they, at least you find out if he actually did mail letters, but they don't know whether he mailed one letter, five letters, 10 letters, zero letters, but they do know that when he was found and they went through his pants and all of that kind of stuff, there were no 82 cent stamps. They were gone.
Yeah, and that goes back to tracking down those waste bins and if they knew where they were at the dump, because if they started to find in the trash these stamps and things like that, they would knew they had the correct garbage because, you know, they know exactly what he purchased. It's just we don't know if he ever sent it out to an address. And, you know, I will always question if he had cold feet and he backed out of sending stuff because he goes on to do things later to where he backs out often. He starts to do something and then he thinks, no, I'm not going to do this.
So we kind of, he may or may not, maybe probably knew where the cameras were. One of the things is he didn't have a car. And as you mentioned at the beginning, you know, he did have a condition which was very serious. It was terminal. And he probably couldn't walk very far. And so he wasn't taking these purple bags very far at all. But no member of the public ever came forward to say they noticed him. No member of the public ever noticed his purple bag. No member of the public ever saw him. And he did all this in daylight. It wasn't as if he was sneaking around at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, and I think that's why he wasn't very memorable to the people that he did have contact with, because like you said, it's in broad daylight, you know, in open sight. So he's not, people don't think it's that suspicious. They're going about their daily life. They're the bus driver, the train driver. You know, they're busy. They deal with, you know, hundreds, thousands of customers, and Peter Bergman just didn't stand out for them. It seems like the taxi driver got him at least twice, and he becomes the most, let me say, memorable witness, because he said that Peter Bergman had asked him to take him to a beach, and he expected, you know, Peter Bergman to get out of the car because he had mentioned something about a beach to swim at. But no, he just wanted the taxi driver to roll by the beach, allow him to look out the window at it. And he was like, OK, that's enough. You can take me back to the hotel now.
Yeah. So that was on Sunday. Although go back for a second, because the police thought that he had training, that he was either ex-military or ex-police that knew where the CCTV cameras would be. But part of if he had that training. I mean, I guess it was important for him to not be noticed. Maybe it was just second nature, but he wasn't really consciously trying to do it, because I don't.
I wonder what ex-military or ex-police he'd be a part of, because it seems like that one of those guys would have remembered him training at a public safety annex or, you know, in some type of special forces training or something like that. They recall faces. Military men, they never forget. Police, they never forget.
Yeah, I just, because it was, you know, this time of year and everything, but close to when he was going to pass and everything, I find it hard to wrap my head around the fact that he was probably in so much pain, but still taking these great efforts to not actually avoid, the cameras and stuff. It seems like a lot of extra work to do with somebody who was this close to death.
So if you have someone that well trained and yet no one steps forward to recall their face, this is where the spy theory comes in. You know, was he ex-intelligence? Was he, you know, someone that had aged out and, you know, they were in a phase of in their life to where They knew they were terminally ill. They don't want to be bothered because they have a history that they need to protect, perhaps people they need to protect, but they want to go out on their own terms. And, you know, that's a possibility.
So now we move into Sunday. Sunday. And Sunday was the third and final night that he spent in Sligo. And like you said, he went in search of a taxi. He had a map in his hand, which means to me, because he did have this map, that maybe he didn't know the town as well as we thought. And so the guy who's the first, the taxi cab driver, was this guy named Gerard Higgins. And Gerard gets out of his little minibus to say hello, because he's got this guy who's got a map. And so let's talk about the map. And the guy, I guess Bergman says, I want to look for a place to swim. And he points to a place on the map. And the cab driver, being very helpful, says, oh, that particular one's a surfing beach. You probably don't want to go there. So let me suggest this place, which turns out to be the place of death, Ross's Point. And it had, I guess, beautiful, long, sandy beaches, and the passenger gets in. And this time he actually talks to him.
Okay, so if this guy, he has this map, he sees a body of water he wants to go visit, and then the taxi driver says, okay, that beach is very choppy, it's dangerous, you know, high current, things like that for, you know, he's probably looking at the guy's age and thinking, you can't handle that. But if Peter Bergman, right, wants to commit suicide and this is his plan all along, wouldn't you want to go to the choppy beach? It seems like you would want to get carried out on the strongest waves ever. You know, you'd want that current to take you out and then you would possibly never be found. You know, put you closer to marine life and your body deteriorating, things like that. You know, things we don't like to think about, but, you know, it's part of this case. Why would he pick the tame beach?
I think he picked the tame beach because he kind of put himself in a corner because he said, I want to find a place to swim. And the cab driver goes, you can't swim there. It's a surfing beach. You just, I'll take you to a swimming beach, but you can't swim there. And then he what's he going to say? Because then if he starts arguing with him, then he's really going to stand out and just say, well, no, I'd rather go to that one anyway. Oh, okay. Well, I thought you wanted to swim and you can't swim there. Well, just take, you know, saying it just involves a lot more questions and a lot more conversation. And
yeah, but
then,
his life is already an entire lie. He could have been like, I'm a pro surfer. And you know what? The taxi driver would have been none the wiser. He'd been like, oh, okay, you're pro,
true.
You're pro, whatever. So he goes on to tell the taxi driver that he's from Austria. So the taxi driver was at least able to pull that out of him. And he said, you know, what I recall about this guy was that he had this prominent gold tooth. And, you know, that means he had some expensive dental work in his mouth.
Yeah. And they did, when they examined his body, he had a gold tooth in the upper back right of his mouth. And so the cab drivers are good at this kind of thing because they see so many people and they're good at chatting people up. And he asks the cab driver, Bergman asks the cab driver, if there's any buses that go out to this Ross's Point. And he said, yeah, there's one every hour. And I think that that's probably the most important thing to him, is that there are buses, because buses provide a little bit of anonymity that you don't get in the cab. And also, if he got the same cab driver yet again later when he goes out to the beach, then there's going to be even more questions and then he's going to get more out of him.
Yeah, you can tell he's ready to ditch this guy. He's like, I can't keep getting him. He's asking too many questions. So, I mean, it's very strange to be in a taxi with a guy who's willing to take you anywhere, you know, every day that you're in town, and yet you're saying, you know, oh, can I get a bus? You know, can you give me information on a different transit? It's, you know, it's kind of rude, but it seems like Peter Bergman, he didn't care. He's an equal opportunity offender. He didn't care if he hurt people's feelings.
Yeah, and remember, he tells the cab driver, I want to go swimming, but he didn't go swimming. And then the cab driver says, we drove around Ross's Point. I showed him the two beaches and I stopped at the car park at the entrance to the beach. He did not get out and then said, can you bring me to the bus station? And that was kind of odd because it's just kind of a little reconnaissance. Okay, well, that beach will work. And so the cab driver brings him back to Sligo, drops him off at the bus station and gives him his card and says, hey, if you want a taxi again, call. And then gave him a brand new 20 euro note. That's interesting to me that the cab driver even said it was brand new 20 euro note. You usually get those from a bank. or, I mean, possibly an ATM, but, you know, just to get that new one. And I wonder if he specifically wanted new ones whenever he got the cash.
Yeah, it makes you wonder at what point did he stop at a bank or an ATM or anything like that to get a crisp bill, because, again, that's not on CCTV either.
No, so that probably was not done in Sligo, because that would be pretty easy, I think, for a bank to go look at its ATMs and just check out those 3 days or whatever and see who withdrew money. That's a pretty easy one to do. But yeah, so he wasn't on any of those. So he got it before he came to town. So that was Sunday. Now we're on Monday. And Peter says, hey, calls down the front desk, I'd like a late checkout, please. And so he gets a 1 o'clock. They said, sure. And he goes down, turns in his key, and we know what he's wearing because of the CCTV. Long sleeve, pale blue shirt, black tank top, which is interesting, dark trousers, and again, his black leather jacket.
Yeah, his styling choices go on to be good questionable from here. But there was an incident before he checked out, and they don't say if it happened on that Friday or that Saturday or that Sunday, but he was in his room, and he didn't have a no disturb sign up, but a maid came to the door and knocked, and he didn't answer the door, so she let herself in, and she spooked him. She said that he jumped 6 feet, acted like he was doing something he was not supposed to be doing, but he looked relieved when she said, I'm with the staff, the maid service here. He almost thought that it was someone else coming in on him. And she said that was just a very weird exchange that I had with him. He was very jumpy.
That is interesting. That is really interesting. Because, well, he could have also been scared, but, maybe he was writing one of his letters or doing something else. I don't think that he was probably doing anything illegal or spy related.
I don't either. Maybe it was just him toying with his stuff and the things that he needed to get rid of that he didn't want people to see. Because, if he didn't unpack the bag in front of you, you would have never have known what any of his bags contained, because he just filled his little purple bags up. You couldn't see inside of it. You could just tell it's filled with junk, and then he would discard them. So he didn't maybe want anyone to see what it was that he was discarding. It just makes you wonder. If it's just books and papers and things like that, what's the big deal? The maid wouldn't have known what she was looking at. She probably wouldn't have cared, but, could it have been more than that?
Well, he leaves, and when he leaves, he's got his duffel bag. He's got the laptop bag with the shoulder strap, and he's also holding a purple plastic bag. Usually you can tell, police are good at it. They can tell how much or how heavy something is, if it's really heavy, by the way that you're carrying the bag. And I wonder if the duffel bag was way lighter when he's leaving than when he came in. How could there be anything left in this duffel bag after 13 trips with the purple bag?
There may not have been.
I know.
He keeps one of the bags that he arrived with, but then he made a purchase of a brand new bag. So was he carrying around this new empty bag? I mean, what was the purpose of getting a new bag at all? Unless he knows he's going to be on CCTV with this new bag at some point. So if you're getting rid of stuff, why would you collect more stuff? I mean, when it comes to the whole spy angle, spies will burn stuff. The professionals will have burn bags and things like that. They're not discarding stuff in waste bins. So, that's kind of like part of the story that I question, like you wouldn't be throwing things away if you were professional intelligence. I think that, it might be something different.
Well, here's what I don't get. Obviously, the cameras aren't as good as they say that they are, because he checks out after 1 o'clock. No taxi driver took him the distance to the Sligo bus station, which isn't far. So everybody assumes that he walked. Okay, well, if you have him leaving there, but so there's no so their whole thing is him avoiding the cameras, It sounds like you don't have any cameras in between the hotel and the bus station. So obviously he could be dumping stuff in the trash can and you guys wouldn't see it. It's not a matter of him avoiding it. It's a matter of the fact that you guys don't have cameras in between.
Yeah. So he took the path of least resistance. He must have known that it wasn't littered with, Big Brother surveillance. So he's walking and he's got this bag, and then again, a blind spot. So they say, you know, it could just be that there's no cameras there. And then the next time he's seen on CCTV, he is sans a bag.
Yeah. So he gets to the bus station at 1:32. He leaves, checks out shortly after 1 o'clock. It is a small distance between the two. So we have about 30 minutes. That's way more time to walk than is needed. But yeah, he doesn't have the duffel bag anymore. It's just, and here's the thing with the, it is possible that with all those purple bag trips and everything, he didn't need it, but why would he, you know, take it with him? But they said that it looked, to be kind where if it was empty, you could kind of press it to the sides together and it would just slide right into a trash can rather than having to be stuffed in there. It was that kind of thing. If you can imagine that in your head,
if you watch the CCTV footage, you can tell, you know, if you've watched this stuff often, which I do, you can tell the fabric of the bag and that it would be easy foldable. I am completely on board with that theory.
My next question is, if it's so foldable up, so can be made so compact, would it not fit in his laptop bag or that other bag? And having to just have it in there rather than when he's checking out, he's got the bag still in his hand. Is it because he thinks, well, the desk clerk might say, you had three bags when you came in or two bags and now you only have one. Did you leave it in your room? Is that the reason? Because I feel as if it was small enough and compact enough to go into a trash can, then it's compact enough to go into his laptop bag.
I don't know. I would question why he cared. Again, if this is someone that is planning to commit suicide, what do you care about how other people view you or what they're going to think because you're not going to be here tomorrow? And in a second, did the desk clerk, would she even have noticed? You know, I tend to think if they had not went back and watched their own CCTV footage, would she ever have really recalled what Peter Bergman was holding? Because she said he wasn't memorable in her witness statements. So I tend to think they went back and they watched it and they were like, oh, okay, well, yeah, he had two bags and then it goes down to one. And
yeah. And so he gets to the bus station 1:30. He actually is hungry and there's a little cafe there and he has a cappuccino and a little toasted sandwich and he sits at a table. There's not very many and he sits next to a woman, but he did not speak to her. And what they also see on CCTV is that he's at the table and he takes a piece of paper from his pocket and then I guess a writing instrument and he writes something on it. Then he tore it up. And obviously it wasn't retrieved, but just what is he writing on a piece of paper? And it's a piece of paper. It's not a big, you know, it's not a paper. It's just interesting that he just has it in his pocket, writes, and then tears it up.
That's one of the moments that I call cold feet. And that's why I question if he ever went on to mail anything to anyone, because to sit down and write something is like you have the intention that you may want to have something to say. And then you're like, no, forget it. And you tear it up. And I tend to think that that's possibly what happened to the mail as well.
So you think that that was maybe a suicide note, didn't write it. But is that different than, you know, mailing stuff that to people? Because it could have been, you know, not necessarily a note. He could have been sending money or a check or something to somebody. I get what you're saying about suicide note and then backs out of it.
Any kind of note. I love you. Don't look for me. I'm going away. I have business in another country. There's no telling what he goes on to tell people because no one is looking for him. So either he has a history that they know they can't out him and they can't say that they know him and to put him on a missing persons list, or maybe his family had completely died off. There's just no clue as to who he would have been sending stuff to.
I'm going to go with the latter, what you just said. I think that he has no family. I think he has nobody. And if he was in this kind of career or whatever, perhaps he never was married, or perhaps his wife died, or perhaps they got divorced 30 or 40 years earlier and never had kids, so there was nobody looking for him. Because I do feel as if he had a family. This is a popular enough case. And that if he was from Austria or some German country, and it's not that long ago, all of this took place within the internet, within Reddit, within all kinds of social media, that somebody would come forward.
Yeah. And I mean, if they really wanted to look into this, if Ireland or Austria, any of these countries, okay, they have the existence of the DNA search the same that we have. You know, these whole GED matches where you can use different companies. They don't have to use the pair bond that all the Americans run to. You can use whatever and try to figure out at this point, you know, a family tree. I don't know what kind of evidence that they still store, you know, if they have anything of Peter Bergman's left. But, you know, it seems like that, you know, as much as they kept with the Somerton man, seems like they would have kept something in this case. But there must be a reason why they get to a stumbling block of completing the investigation. I mean, this can go a lot further. It's like it's their selection in law enforcement not to go the extra step. And perhaps they know who he is. You know, I tend to think they do, because in a lot of these cases where any type of spy activity, ex-military, ex-police, that kind of stuff's involved, they never go the extra mile.
I think I don't know if they know. And I think that I don't know. It's not 1989 or 79 or whatever. It's 2009. I think that if they knew who he was, I don't know. I think that they would say, oh, well, he used to be a spy or something. I don't know. I think that they would put some kind of closure on it in this particular case. I get it a lot of times where they wouldn't, but he appears retired or at least medically retired at this point. So I don't know. But,
I don't know. Ross's Point Beach, though, just makes you wonder what special memory did he hold there? You know, did he have family memories? Why this place? You know, he has this, he says he's from Austria, but he has a Sherman accent. So he's obviously not from Ireland, but he travels back here. He selects this place as the point to end his life. This would be the last surroundings that he ever sees. And that's really poignant.
It is, but I don't think that he had, I don't think he had been there as in some special memory, because he wouldn't have said, oh, I'm looking for a swimming beach or something like that. He would have known, with especially with his memory and everything, that, okay, this is, I want to go to Ross's Point or something. I don't think he had been there, but maybe he had, I want to die in the sea or something
maybe,
like that.
Maybe he didn't have all of his faculties about him at this point and he was a little confused, or it could have been the latter of it, a bucket list. You know, maybe him a special someone had always wanted to go there. But, you know, time runs out, people get sick, people pass, and then it's a missed opportunity. So he decides that he's going to do it for the couple. The interesting thing is that he is discovered having carried some things on him, because they recover shampoo bottles from the hotel, you know, his clothing and things like that. You can't tell me they couldn't pull fingerprints off of those shampoo bottles and toiletries that he took from the hotel. You know, there's got to be fingerprints. He touched a lot of stuff.
A lot. And it doesn't sound like he wiped everything. So that's the other thing. If he didn't wipe everything, but again, they didn't go back and look for several weeks. So other people had stayed in the room. So they couldn't really go back and do anything like that because they just didn't really care.
One opportunity would have been for touch DNA and stuff on the things collected at the beach.
Yeah. So on this day, so on Monday, after he's eaten his toasted sandwich, it's about 2 o'clock. This guy goes up to the guy in charge of the bus station there, and he asked when the next bus to Ross's Point left, and it was at, actually he knew what time the bus left, but he didn't know where to catch it. So he had obviously done his research and he knew what time it left. And he had probably figured that out the day before when the taxi driver dropped him there. But, you know, I don't remember them saying whether or not they saw him on CCTV that day on Sunday when the cab driver dropped him there. But anyway, he knows that it leaves at 2:40. And that's what the question was to this guy. There's 3 buses. After the 2:40 p.m., I guess, time or whatever, but he wanted that 2:40 p.m. He wanted that one. Why? Why did he want that one? So specific.
Maybe he wanted to ensure that he was there by sunset, ensure that he was there by, you know, I don't know, tides, whatever it was that was important to him. I don't know what his bucket list was like when it came to this beach or why he wanted this beach. If he was planning on swimming, currents would have been a big factor. So maybe the timing of that, you know, high tide, low tide, things like that.
Yeah. And so he's not taking a taxi, but he needs to be on that 2:40 p.m. bus. And again, this could go back to what you said. You know, maybe he wasn't completely in his right mind and then he's just focused on 2:40, 2:40, 2:40, because he didn't have a reservation at a hotel or anything. It didn't appear that he had any place to be. He's already checked out of his own hotel. So maybe he was just, maybe that's the time when he got dropped off the day before. Maybe he just memorized 2:40 p.m. And that's why he wanted the late checkout, 1 o'clock. You know, I'll go have a bite to eat and I'll make this 2:40 p.m. one. That's what he memorized. So he was just all in on the 2:40 p.m. one.
Yeah, and if he did have all of his faculties about him and he is someone that, you know, wasn't having a problem connecting the dots, so to speak, it could have just been pain because he did have this debilitating terminal condition to where when the pain kicked in, it should have floored him. You know, for a guy that was not taking anything for pain, this pain should have been like really paralyzing to him. So it could have been to where pain affects your memory, you know, to where you're going through the motions, but you're just trying to get through. And the fact that he wanted to go swimming, you know, I wonder if that's therapeutic, if he thought that that might make him feel better.
Yeah. You know, that's actually something that I hadn't thought about. But yeah, swimming could make him feel better. But the bus station person said, I just thought he was going to meet somebody or be on business because they said, you know, later I learned that he went swimming, but he wasn't dressed for it. It just because they go, you know, when people go out there, they've got towels, you know, things like that. Day at the beach kind of stuff. And it didn't look like that with him. The leather jacket and everything just looked like he was going on a business trip.
That is so strange. And he said that the guy didn't look stressed. He didn't look like he was in pain. You know, he just looked like an average guy going about his day. And I mean, people came in contact with him. You know, a couple saw him. And, you know, for the first time, he actually acknowledged them. He smiled at them and he made eye contact in a way that he was actually being pleasant at that moment. And that's something that he had not done previously.
Yeah, because he didn't even tell this guy thank you for the information. He just turned and walked away. Which is
that's who he was. I said he was just an equal opportunity offender, you know, letting the doors close on people, not saying any type of courtesies, thank you, none of that.
That day got up to about 65 degrees or so, 17 centigrade. So I'm going to guess about 65. The 65 degrees, and there was a lot of people there swimming, walking the beach, even though it's a Monday. And that's the thing. It's the middle of the day. It's not nighttime. There's people there. There's people watching him and, you know, a lot of potential witnesses, whether or not they're, you know, they reported or remember him. There are a lot of potential witnesses that he's going to have to deal with if he, is trying to be discreet or something.
It's interesting that he wanted to go swimming. And yet I question, how did he know about the different tides? Because it says that at 12:06, there would be one high tide at heights over 3 meters above the average low water mark. And then the next high tide, 12:25 a.m. So, see, he needed to make it there, I guess, at a certain time. But what was he utilizing to learn tides? Unless he just came, like I said, packing that information, like having previously visited and just knew.
Yeah, and he was there a long time without eating, essentially, because they got dropped off at 3 o'clock at this hotel. That's where the bus stop was, and nobody at the hotel ever recalled him coming in for coffee or food or to use the bathroom. Apparently, I guess they don't have CCTV or they would have checked, so they're just going by witness recollection. So he might have actually come in there and ordered food and they just don't remember. And at 4 o'clock, so we got him there at 3:00. At 4 o'clock, he's seen on the beach. He's got the laptop bag over his shoulder. At 5 o'clock, he was seen near the yacht club at the far left, I guess, of what local people call the first beach. And that has a very symbolic name to what we're talking about now. It's called Dead Man's Point.
It's so weird in these cases how things come up, like the Devil's Gulch, the Devil's Seat, and now you have Dead Man's Point. And I mean, it's like this Coney Island type place, right? This little small headland that extends outwards and it has this strange tale connected to it.
So the story goes that a seaman from another land died as his ship was entering Sligo Bay and was left behind and buried there because the crew didn't want to miss the tide, and that he was buried with a loaf of bread and a shovel should he wake again. So there's And this is where, you know, Yeats, the poet and everything, would holiday with his family and stuff. So he would write about it. So this Dead Man's Point is big on lore and things like that. But it is Dead Man's Point. So he's seen it four. He's seen it five. But then we don't see him again for about 4 hours. Well, I mean, he's probably there, but nobody remembers seeing him. But think about this. He got there at 3. He hasn't eaten since 1:30 in the afternoon. It is now 9 o'clock. 9:10, actually. But don't forget, it's daylight. It is going to be daylight out there. Where it's not dark. And he's seen by two women carrying something, but they weren't sure what it was. Do you think it was a laptop bag?
Yeah, probably. It could have been that black laptop bag. You know, so you see a guy, he's wearing his leather jacket. He's walking up and down the beach with his black bag. He never sets it down, so it doesn't look like that he's going to pitch a picnic or start to unroll, like they said, a towel or anything that makes you believe that he's going to take a swim. He's not relaxing. You know, he's pacing. And that's the last time that he's seen. And they fall. That's really strange.
Yeah, so at 9:30, there's this this couple, and it's the last time but to give you an idea, they came at 9:30 to see the sunset. So now we understand about what time the sun is setting, and they thought it was weird because they said, well, we were parked at the upper parking lot, and there's a man, he's just, like you said, walking parallel to the shore, had his trousers rolled up to his knees and was wearing a black jacket, and he was walking, they said it was plodding. That's the term they used. Plodding ponderously along. And they remembered him because he was walking so funny, like stepping very deliberately.
That is so weird. That we had a case similar to this, didn't we? Annie Bergerson, she was last seen on a Swedish beach or something. Could be a Norway beach. I'll have to go back and look. But same thing. Two witnesses, a couple saw her and thought, well, she's acting odd. It's the same thing with Peter Bergman. And then they both end up washed up.
Yeah. And so the crowds have finally started to leave. So that's why they pay so much attention to him, because they're in their car and they're watching the sunset. And so they see him because he keeps going in and out of their vision, because they're watching where the sun's coming down and their point that they have fixated on. He is walking back and forth in front of that. So the sun is kind of illuminating him. If he's trying to be invisible, he has picked the wrong place, because they're staring right at him.
He's got this shadow effect going on. So he's walking in, you know, back and forth in front of the sun. It's creating this illuminating effect, making a silhouette that is very visible. And he's deliberately stepping one foot in front of the other. And they said it appeared to be ritualistic in fashion.
Yeah. So... And he's just doing it back and forth. It's just, is he getting up the nerve? Is that what we think? I don't know. I just.
Possibly. I mean, since there's this Dead Man's Point and there's a story linked to it, and, you know, the guy gets buried and he has to get there at a certain time when the high tide, it just seems like that Peter Bergman may have been an avid reader, and who knows what other books he went on to read and what he is acting out at this point. Because if it looked deliberate, then it probably was. You know, you see someone moving in this, very bizarre pattern. You know, it doesn't mean anything to the observer, but to the person doing it, it probably meant a lot. So I do think that he was probably carrying out a ritual of some sort in his head, and, you know, building up the nerve and also figuring out, how do I really want to go out, maybe?
Yeah. So this couple, I'm 100% convinced, saw him. They this was not, hey, you know, the police need your help. They saw it. Their story is too good. They were watching him constantly, so I'm sure that they did. There were three other people who said that they saw him, but I'm not really sure, because we're starting to get dark now, and it's 10:30 p.m. Somebody said that they saw him with a plastic bag and wearing his glasses, and then at 11 o'clock, he was seen by a different person with a plastic bag. So we've lost the laptop bag somewhere. Now he's just got the plastic bag. And then a third person said that he was wearing his glasses sitting on a bench that overlooked the first beach. But this would have been the first time that I think that he sat down. And the couple that was watching in the car, it was 9:30. So he's still kind of, well, I guess, maybe getting up the nerve. He's throwing stuff away. I don't know. But there's one final person. A woman says that she saw him almost at midnight. There's a lot of people on this beach. who
it is. I mean, it seems like it's the place to go to watch the sunset. It's a romantic thing to do. And, you know, like in these sleepy coastal towns, there's not much else you can really do besides just enjoy the beach. And, you know, not all these people were tourists. You know, some were locals. And like you said, he goes on to ditch the bag. I wonder if he ditched it in one of the bins at the yacht club. You know, it seems like that had been easier to check those bins, you know, compared to the ones in the city. But again, it seems like they ran out of time. And then he's seen with these grocery bags. He's in the water. He's now out of the water. I mean, it does seem like he has some type of buyer's remorse. Like maybe he don't want to do it.
Yeah. Or as is the case, maybe he's waiting for high tide. Because this woman says, I saw him at 11:50 carrying the plastic bag and then walking along the edge. And then high tide. And that's a big high tide. 3 meters above. It's going to be pretty deep. And then we also know, if you think about the tale about why it's called Dead Man's Point, that the tide is important to getting out. I guess it goes really low because they didn't want to get stuck there when they're burying the guy. So they want to get out because of the tide. So this is going to be a pretty big high tide. This is going to be more dangerous than just a normal high tide where it's really tough to tell. And that's the only thing I can think of is that the couple definitely, I think that they saw him for sure. The other ones, it depends. They all said the plastic bag and the glasses. But again, I know it doesn't really get dark until super, super late. And especially pitch black, even though the sun is set. But I don't know. That's a lot of people.
I wonder about his, why he has like a magnetic personality towards the sea. You know, was he himself a boat captain, some sort of, I don't know, Navy man from his country or something like that? You know, usually men that spend their life on the water want to go back to the water.
Good point.
So that's
but
also,
he's from Austria,
you know,
something so I don't know.
About. Yeah, I know. So I know that part is confusing. You know, if he's Austrian, it's like, what did he belong to? But, you know, if he was reading these books about a boat captain, you know, to me, it's like you have some type of connection to the sea and you want to go back to it.
So now we go to the, you know, on the beach when he's dead, and they pronounce him dead at the scene, and his body was taken to the hospital to wait an autopsy. And you have the detectives, they're on Ross's Point Beach, and they're searching for the rest of the clothes and footwear that had been discarded somewhere. So they found a pile of clothes on a rock on the beach, and they matched the description of what the witnesses said that they had seen him wearing the previous day. And they were clothes, obviously, that no one other swimmer came to reclaim. And it was, so I guess he took off his shoes, took off his socks, put the socks in the shoes, and then his trousers. And then there's a black V-neck shirt, and they were all folded nice and neat on top of the other. And then what you said very beginning, all the labels have been cut out.
Yeah, all the labels cut out. And then there's a report that he was naked. And then there's a report that he had on.
Like a Speedo or something?
Yeah, like these weird shorts. Okay. And then he put his, like the Speedo underwear over them. So that would be like quite the fashion choice.
And it would be.
That's where I start to question, like, you know, did he have all of his faculties? What was going on there? But it could have just been the whole, his condition and maybe the pain down in that region. And maybe that was something that made him comfortable.
That's true. Maybe we should say that he was going to die of prostate cancer. So I think that that's actually what you just said. I hadn't even thought about that because, you know, to wear underwear and then have Speedo on over the underwear is, like you said, it's a fashion choice. But it could have been maybe the Speedo just by itself would have just really caused him too much pain. So he had to wear underwear beneath the Speedo. And maybe because he had to wear it like that, maybe he didn't want to be seen during the day in the daylight swimming like that. So he wanted to swim at night. If you want to just throw out a reason.
Or self-preservation. He knows that he's going to end his life and he's going to eventually wash up, you know, maybe. And if he does, then he wants to have the self-preservation of people not seeing him, you know, completely nude.
Yeah,
it is odd though that the clothes they found were just very nicely folded. You know, he folded his clothes and set his shoes and everything down perfectly. And you
We've
see
that
in
before,
a lot
though.
Of yeah, and the Beautiful Suicide. She did that. A lot of different people that took their life have done similar things.
You know, I do not do. You know, I obviously you're very invested in true crime and stuff, and you know, the time that I spend with it is usually just with you. But it's these things that these repeated behaviors that just as soon as you said, oh, the folding of the clothes, you did so neatly. And I just think about every, you know, how many other times we have talked about this and how many times people fold stuff up or put the shoes down, like the guy who jumped off the roof or something like that, right? Puts the shoes down, and does all that really nicely. And, the person, the one we just did with the Asian one where they were wearing red, didn't they fold everything all up and stuff like that?
Yes. Behavior analysis is everything when you're building a profile on, you say you're the medical examiner, you're the investigator on this case. You have to figure out manner of death, cause of death. You know, their behavior will help you make a decision in that. And it seems like they came to the decision that no foul play was involved and that he did take his own life just because of the series, you know, with what the scene presented. You know, the clothes are folded. It doesn't seem like he has any marks on his body that he struggled. You know, it just seems like this was on his own terms.
Well, the Irish Times, 10 years after the death, they went and they kind of followed this and they interviewed everybody that was still around, like the bus depot guy and the taxi driver and anybody that they could find who had a run-in with Bergman. And they talked to the detective and everything. And they went and they looked. They went to the Sligo police station, and all his clothes are still there in a box. And the label on the lid that reads clothing, personal items of unidentified body found at Ross's Point on June 16th, 2009. So the reporters, they actually got to look at them and they got to touch them. And when this shows you that nobody's really looked at this case since then, at least the clothes, but they said that the t-shirt, they took the t-shirt out of the box and sand started to fall. I mean, just all over the desk. So they were in the sand, they put them in the box and they hadn't been open since.
That's crazy. If they have these clothes, right? So there's going to be fibers, perhaps follicles, things like that on there. There are labs now that can do amazing things in forensics when it comes to taking the most just minuscule clue and building a profile out of it. You know, they can tell a lot from those clothes if they were willing to go the extra mile. Yes, it costs money, but they have GoFundMes up for all these different UID cases, and he would be a great one to have a GoFundMe for. People would be willing to put in the effort if, you know, these different countries would allow it, you know, if Ireland would allow it. And it just seems like they're protective of this case.
There's way more than clothes. I'm going to give you the list of what the Irish Times found in the box. A Navy t-shirt. This is what he's wearing. A Navy t-shirt, Navy underpants, the Speedo swimming trunks with pink and purple stripes. Again, a fashion choice. Waterproof quartz watch found on his left wrist. Found on the rocks were thin comfort shoes, size 44, manufactured in 2002 in Germany. So that gives you a clue. Dark socks, a black leather CNA jacket, Navy CNA chino trousers. That's a clothing store in Europe, CNA. A black sleeveless Tommy Hilfiger jumper, a black leather belt called Key West USA, made in Italy. And then in various pockets were 140 euros in notes, 9 euros in coins in an envelope, a packet of tissues, 55 milligrams of aspirin tablets made by Bayer, manufactured in the Czech Republic, but distributed in Germany. So we got another Germany thing. Band-aids, a bar of hotel soap, but that they said was not a brand made or stocked in any hotels in Ireland. So, but they didn't find were his glasses that everybody said he was wearing, the stamps, the blue shirt that he was wearing when he left the hotel, or his laptop bag, or the purple plastic bag. And there was no ID of any kind. That's a lot of stuff.
That is a lot of stuff. Yeah. I mean, we don't even need the other stuff because they have so much already that is preserved. Why they're not doing anything with it is just beyond my comprehension. It does seem like someone did a little bit of legwork when it comes to figuring out where the textiles came from, the shoes.
The reporters did. That's what the reporters did.
Well, so good
on
them.
They're doing all the work. It seems to me, I know there's a lot of times where we don't have anything. He's touching the notes. He touched the coins. He touched the aspirin. He touched the Band-Aid box. You know, he touched the shoes. I know the fingerprints fade over time, probably. Yeah. I don't know. Do they?
Yeah. I mean, they can, but this was fresh. I mean, his body he was alive, and the next day he was found. Those fingerprints and stuff, it was on the dry beach, so those fingerprints are going to still be on there. I doubt that he wiped all that stuff down before he got into the water, and still they have his trousers, and you know, I don't mean to be crude, but you've got hair follicles from the nether region. Those are very helpful. You'll definitely get like the nuclei that you can use for DNA testing and stuff like that to drop into, you know, like a family tree, GED match type situation, and try to find if he's got kinfolk. And then you can find out, was he German? You know, just build a tree on this guy. Why they haven't went any further, I don't understand.
Well, he, okay. When he
because
checked
the public's
in,
invested. I mean, let's be real. There's so many people that have covered this and so many journalists. I mean, this is like a worldwide interest piece. So when it is that well known and the mystery is that great, it's like the Somerton Man, you know, you need to go the extra mile.
Yeah. Well, this is why I also think that he doesn't have any family members, because it's not an old case. It's fairly new. There's been so much publicity. Everybody just, it's impossible to me that he has any family, or they would have stepped forward and say, yeah, it's my dad, my uncle, my cousin, whatever, my friend. But he gave when he checked in, he had to give an address on the thing. It was someplace in Austria, but it doesn't exist. even the postal code, he gave a postal code of 4472, and apparently in Austria it goes from 1000 to 1901, and he gave 4472 or something. But one
Jennifer
of the things
Fergate and an Isdal woman did the exact same thing. They put addresses down, and they went to nowhere.
But can I tell you that he has been in Austria? Because if you had to know that it's a 4-digit postal code, because that's not just something that you're probably going to know off the top of your head. And because I didn't know that Austria has a 4-digit postal code, you know,
He seems like a guy that's well traveled.
Yeah, that's true. But I think it's just this unique thing, because remember he said he was from Austria, but maybe that was just his cover story, in case the cab driver went and asked, hey, what about the guy from Austria? Well, we don't have anybody here from Austria, kind of thing. I don't know. So they did the autopsy, and this goes back to something that you mentioned about the Irish not really pushing this. Because he died, the autopsy was done on June 17th, the day after he died. But it wasn't made public for almost a year, April 14th, 2010. But so the idea is, 10 months after this, people have started to forget. They're not inquiring. The trail has gone cold because people aren't really talking about it for 10 months. And what they found was two important things that the public finally learned. He didn't drown. He did not die by drowning.
They said that about Annie Borgerson too, that she had no salt water in her lungs, and then here is Peter. He doesn't have any salt water in his lungs either, so they said it's not a classic salt water drowning. So it's like, what is his cause of death? You know, he didn't just step into the ocean and succumb to the prostate cancer. Like, there's just no way, right?
No, but they said that he only probably had weeks at most to live because of the prostate cancer, because it had spread to his bones, his chest, his lungs. This is what I think. I think this is what happened. And because they said that he died, the reason he died was a heart attack, essentially. How about this? That water's got to be cold. So, so cold. And he is thin. He is dying. And I wouldn't shock me if the ice cold water would give him a heart attack.
Yeah, maybe he's just waited or floated on the top of the water until he became so cold that it overtook his body, and he was suffering from maybe, I don't know, some type of hyperthermia, and it caused the heart arrhythmia. That could be a thing. They did test the aspirin in the bottle to see if it was any type of poison, and they said no, it was actually real bare aspirin.
So yeah, I mean,
what could he have taken that would have triggered the heart attack?
No, that's what I'm saying. I think that what you just said, hypothermia, and then you start shivering so uncontrollably. It's not going to take much to for a guy who's going to die in a couple weeks at the most because of cancer, who's super thin and ice cold. It's not going to take much to give you a heart attack in that kind of situation.
Then he must have known, right? Because he stayed out there. You know, if you were going into distress, you'd start trying to get back to shore. You know, we don't know how far out he was, but no, he stays out there until he succumbs. It just makes you, curious where he got that idea from of how did he know that would work? Because they did do a toxicology on him for just a broad range of banned substances and even like the stuff that's really hard to trace. They went all the way on that. Nothing.
Yeah. No, I think he knew that he would probably, he researched what hypothermia and stuff, and maybe that's why he waited till everybody was gone when it was finally dark. Because if he had done it in the daylight, people would have been maybe watching him and try to stop him or something. So, but here he is doing it at some point after 11:50 p.m. and nobody's there to watch him, and he's wearing, if he wasn't naked, he's wearing, he's just blending into the dark, into the sand. I don't even think that he went very far into the water. So he didn't need to. That's kind of, I'm not so much about his death. It's just, why did he pick this place? Why did he do this? And one of the things is they didn't cremate him. Good. So they buried him and they put him in, I guess, technically like a pauper's grave or something like that. But usually they'll put more people. There's only two people in the grave. So that way, because they know that at some point they're going to have to exhume the body.
Okay. Well, that's good that they're willing to leave that open. You know, if something, I don't know, if they get the wild idea to try a DNA bank search or something like that, they will exhume him. You know, his funeral was attended by four detectives, the undertaker, and the actual grave digger. So, you know, he didn't go alone. He did have some people that were there to, you know, say some last rites and pay some respect to him. But, you know, I just hope in this case that he really did go out on his own terms and, you know, everything was his decision and it wasn't something he was pushed into. And then, you know, he was at peace.
A couple things. One thing that the detective said that I was really taken by is that that maybe he went to Sligo because of their tides and that he had a plan that he was going to disappear at sea, but it didn't happen that way. Maybe he didn't expect to have a heart attack. Maybe when he got in the water, he had the heart attack and he died and he didn't, for sure he wasn't going to drown, and the water didn't take him out like he thought it would.
Why would you not just, if you have the means and you're, you know, a well-traveled person, it seems like he is, why would you not just get on a cruise ship and then jump like Marie Empress is said to have done, and then you would just be gone and there would be no turning back? Once you jump from a cruise that is way out into the sea, you're going to perish. There is no, you know, fighting for your life against the bottomless sea, you know, especially with marine life and stuff like that. Why he chose this is really strange. I just always think that place was special to him.
Yeah. And didn't Marie sneak off dressed as... Anyway, the...
I sure hope so. But I mean, if you're going to do it, that's the way to do it, right? You jump from a cruise ship and then you can't turn back. That is a permanent decision.
But here's the other thing is that because they knew that wasn't his name, so it's really hard to do something. The name that he gave wasn't on any passenger manifest. They don't know how he got to Ireland. There was, because if he had gone to England and then came over on a ferry, they don't get your name. There's nothing for foot passengers or ferries. There's no identity checks. And this is the opposite. When somebody goes missing, usually, have you seen my loved one? Have you seen my loved one? In this case, there's not. There's nobody. And they said at one point there was 10 people working on the case. And there's clear images of his face, both alive and dead. I don't think he has a family.
I don't either. Either he never had one to begin with, or they all perished. And that could be also what's wrong with him. You know, outside of the terminal condition, it could just be grief. And then he returns to this place. Anytime that you see someone giving away their personal effects out of nowhere, especially just about everything they own, things that are special to them, it's always cause for concern. You know, he is seen discarding all of his stuff. And, you know, to me, that is just indicative of a decision that you're not going to be here anymore because, you know, you don't need that stuff.
Now, I said that he doesn't have any family. But as the detective said, you know, nobody gets close to 60. That's what they think he is, without gaining friends, colleagues, neighbors, acquaintances. And how about this? How about a doctor? You must have seen a doctor for the prostate cancer.
Maybe, or since he was not on any prescription medication, I don't know how he was standing the pain, because usually when you reach that stage of cancer, you are so sick and in so much pain that you were desperate for help. It could have been to where he had to have known, right? So maybe it was an emergency situation to where he saw an ER doctor, and those people are less likely to keep up with you, and he may have used a different identity, or perhaps his real government name, so to speak, to get the diagnosis, and then went on to become an alias afterwards.
Yeah, I just...
And that takes out the primary care. You know, if someone that has an established relationship with you, if you only see a doctor one time, yeah. I mean, how memorable are you going to be?
You're
there's
not,
no
yeah,
telling
exactly.
What country.
Yeah, 100%. But if there's any friend, a colleague, I think that's the thing. Even if he was a spy... I don't know. You would think
they
that
at
some
talk,
point,
though, on something like that, you know, like I said, it comes with a history. And if you start talking, then you start outing other people and it unravels things. So if it's a situation of that, then those men and women can't talk. It is what it is. You know, you see a friend pass and, you know, you're sorry, but it's better if, you know, the whole saying loose lips sink ships. You don't say anything.
Well, they need to do an isotope test and just at least give us a region and everything like that.
I would like them to do that and establish if he was really from Austria, like he said, you know, like they have hair follicles and all that kind of stuff. Build that profile up. Let us know what the isotopes, you know, what was the air, pollen and different stuff in his body. Tell us a little bit about him, because they can, for a fact, do that.
Yeah. And they've got the stuff to do it. So.
Yes.
All right. Well, that was a good one for the first day of October. And we will be back with many others in October. So, Jen, I hope that you have a great weekend.
Thank you. I hope you do as well. And, you know, this is a case that people kept asking, you know, what does NT think? And you know, now all of you know.
All of you know. So, everybody have a great weekend. And
have a great weekend and stay safe. And
talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.